Chapter 52. With no pretensions to recent fashion, a soft gray woolen gown, with white crepe quilling against the pink skin of her face and neck, and a black velvet jacket and hat. 'Tis a thousand pities your husband can't see e now you do look a real beauty, said Is Hewitt, regarding Tess as she stood on the threshold between the steely starlight without the yellow candlelight within. Is spoke with a magnanimous abandonment of herself to the situation. She could not be no woman with a heart bigger than a hazelnut could be antagonistic to Tess in her presence, the influence which she exercised over those of her own sex being of a warmth and strength quite unusual, curiously overpowering the less worthy feminine feelings of spite and rivalry. With a final tug and touch here, and a slight brush there, they let her go, and she was absorbed into the pearly air of the foredawn. They heard her footsteps tap along the hard road as she stepped out to her full pace. Even Is hoped she would win, and, though without any particular respect for her own virtue, felt glad that as he had been prevented wronging her friend, when momentarily tempted by Claire. It was a year ago, all but a day, that Claire had married Tess, and only a few days less than a year, that he had been absent from her. Still, to start on a brisk walk, and on such an errand as hers, on a dry clear wintry morning, through the rarefied air of these chalky hawk's backs, was not depressing, and there is no doubt that her dream at starting was to win the heart of her mother-in-law, tell her whole history to that lady, enlist her on her side, and so gain back the truant. In time she reached the edge of the vast escarpment below which stretched the loamy veil of Blackmoor, now lying misty, and still in the dawn. Instead of the colorless air of the uplands, the atmosphere down there was a deep blue. Instead of the great enclosures of 100 acres in which she was now accustomed to toil, there were little fields below her of less than half a dozen acres, so numerous that they looked from this height like the meshes of a net. Here the landscape was whitey brown. Down there, as in Froom Valley, it was always green. Yet Is was in that veil that her sorrow had taken shape, and she did not love it as formerly. Beauty to her, as to all who have felt, lay not in the thing, but in what the thing symbolized. Keeping the veil on her right, she steered steadily westward, passing above the Hintocks, crossing at right angles the high road from Sherton Abbas to Casterbridge, and skirting Dogberry Hill and High Stoy, with the dell between them called the Devil's Kitchen. Still following the elevated way, she reached Cross in Hand, where the stone pillar stands desolate and silent, to mark the site of a miracle, or murder, or both. 3 miles further she cut across the straight and deserted Roman road called Long Ash Lane, leaving which as soon as she reached it, she dipped down the hill by a transverse lane into the small town or village of Evershead, being now about halfway over the distance. She made a halt here, and breakfasted it a second time, hardily enough not at the Sow and Acorn, for she avoided inns, but at a cottage by the church. The second half of her journey was through a more gentle country, by way of Benville Lane. But as the mileage lessened between her and the spot of her pilgrimage, so did Tess's confidence decrease, and her enterprise loom out more formidably. She saw her purpose in such staring lines, and the landscape so faintly, that she was sometimes in danger of losing her way. However, about noon she paused by a gate on the edge of the basin in which Emminster and its vicarage lay. The square tower, beneath which she knew that at that moment the vicar and his congregation were gathered, had a severe look in her eyes. She wished that as he had somehow contrived to come on a weekday. Such a good man might be prejudiced against a woman who had chosen Sunday, never realizing the necessities of her case. But it was incumbent upon her to go on now. She took off the thick boots in which as he had walked thus far, put on her pretty thin ones of patent leather, and, stuffing the former into the hedge by the gatepost, where she might readily find them again, descended the hill, the freshness of color as he had derived from the keen air thinning away in spite of her as she drew near the parsonage. Tess hoped for some accident that might favor her, but nothing favored her. The scrubs on the vicarage lawn rustled uncomfortably in the frosty breeze. She could not feel by any stretch of imagination, dressed to her highest as she was, that the house was the residence of near relations, and yet nothing essential, in nature or emotion, divided her from them. In pains, pleasures, thoughts, birth, death, and after death, they were the same. She nerved herself by an effort, entered the swing gate, and rang the doorbell. The thing was done. There could be no retreat. No, the thing was not done. Nobody answered to her ringing. The effort had be risen to and made again. She rang a second time, and the agitation of the act, coupled with her weariness after the 15 miles walk, let her support herself, while she waited by resting her hand on her hip, and her elbow against the wall of the porch. The wind was so nipping, that the ivy leaves had become wizened and gray, each tapping incessantly upon its neighbor with a disquieting stir of her nerves. A piece of blood-stained paper, caught up from some meat buyer's dust heap, beat up and down the road without the gate, too flimsy to rest, too heavy to fly away, and a few straws kept it company. The second peal had been louder, and still nobody came. Then she walked out of the porch, opened the gate, and passed through. And though she looked dubiously at the house front, as if inclined to return, it was with a breath of relief that she closed the gate. A feeling haunted her that she might have been recognized, though how she could not tell, and orders been given not to admit her. Tess went as far as the corner. As he had done all she could do, but determined not to escape present trepidation at the expense of future distress, she walked back again quite past the house, looking up at all the windows. Ah, the explanation was that they were all a church, every one. She remembered her husband saying that his father always insisted upon the household, servants included, going to morning service, and, as a consequence, eating cold food when they came home. It was, therefore, only necessary to wait till the service was over. She would not make herself conspicuous by waiting on the spot, and she started to get past the church into the lane. But as she reached the churchyard gate, the people began pouring out, and Tess found herself in the midst of them. The Emminster congregation looked at her as only a congregation of small country townsfolk walking home at its leisure can look at a woman out of the common whom it perceives to be a stranger. She quickened her pace, and descended to the road by which she had come, to find a retreat between its hedges till the vicar's family should have lunched, and it might be convenient for them to receive her. She soon distanced the churchgoers, except two youngish men, who, linked arm in arm, were beating up behind her at a quick step. As they drew nearer, she could hear their voices engaged in earnest discourse, and, with the natural quickness of a woman in her situation, did not fail to recognize in those noises the quality of her husband's tones. The pedestrians were his two brothers. Forgetting all her plans, Tess's one dread was lest they should overtake her now, in her disorganized condition, before she was prepared to confront them. For though she felt that they could not identify her, she instinctively dreaded their scrutiny. The more briskly they walked, the more briskly walked she. They were plainly bent upon taking a short, quick stroll before going indoors to lunch or dinner, to restore warmth to limbs chilled with sitting through a long service. Only one person had preceded Tess up the hill, a ladylike young woman, somewhat interesting, though, perhaps, a trifle gindy and prudish. Tess had nearly overtaken her, when the speed of her brothers-in-law brought them so nearly behind her back, that she could hear every word of their conversation. They said nothing, however, which particularly interested her till, observing the young lady still further in front, one of them remarked, "There is mercy chant. Let us overtake her." Tess knew the name. It was the woman who had been destined for Angel's life companion by his and her parents, and whom he probably would have married, but for her interests of self. She would have known as much without previous information, if he had waited a moment, for one of the brothers proceeded to say, "Ah, poor Angel, poor Angel. I never see that nice girl without more and more regretting his precipitancy in throwing himself away upon a dairymaid, or whatever she may be. It is a queer business, apparently. Whether S.E. has joined him yet, or not I don't know, but S.E. had not done so some months ago, when I heard from him. I can't say. He never tells me anything nowadays. His ill-considered marriage seems to have completed that estrangement from me which was begun by his extraordinary opinions. Tess beat up the long hill still faster, but she could not outwalk them without exciting notice. At last they outsped her altogether, and passed her by. The young lady still further ahead heard their footsteps and turned. Then there was a greeting, and a shaking of hands, and the three went on together. They soon reached the summit of the hill, and, evidently intending this point to be the limit of their promenade, slackened pace and turned all three aside to the gate where Tess had paused an hour before that time to reconnoiter the town, before descending into it. During their discourse one of the clerical brothers probed the hedge carefully with his umbrella, and dragged something to light. "Here's a pair of old boots," he said. "Thrown away, I suppose, by some tramp or other. Some impostor who wished to come into the town barefoot, perhaps, and so excite our sympathies," said Miss Chant. "Why yes, it must have been, for they are excellent walking boots by no means worn out. What a wicked thing to do. I'll carry them home for some poor person." Cuthbert Clare, who had been the one to find them, picked them up for her with the crook of his stick, and Tess's boots were appropriated. She, who had heard this, walked past under the screen of her woolen veil, till, presently looking back, she perceived that the church party had left the gate with her boots and retreated down the hill. Thereupon our heroine resumed her walk. Tears, blinding tears, were running down her face. She knew that it was all sentiment, all baseless impressibility, which had caused her to read the scene as her own condemnation. Nevertheless, she could not get over it. She could not contravene in her own defenseless person all those untoward omens. It was impossible to think of returning to the vicarage. Angel's wife felt almost as if S.E. had been hounded up that hill like a scorned thing by those two her superfine clerics. Innocently as the slight had been inflicted, it was somewhat unfortunate that S.E. had encountered the sons, and not the father, who, despite his narrowness, was far less starched and iron than they, and had to the full the gift of charity. As she again, though of her moldy boots, she almost pitied those habiliments for the quizzing to which they had been subjected, and felt how hopeless life was for their owner. "Ah," she said, still sighing in pity of herself, "they didn't know that I wore those over the roughest part of the road, to save these pretty ones he bought for me. No, they did not know it. And they didn't think that he chose the color of my pretty frock. No, how could they? If they had known, perhaps they would not have cared, for they don't care much for him, poor thing." Then she grieved for the beloved man whose conventional standard of judgment had caused her all these latter sorrows, and she went her way without knowing that the greatest misfortune of her life was this feminine loss of courage at the last and critical moment through her estimating her father-in-law by his sons. Her present condition was precisely one which would have enlisted the sympathies of old Mr. and Mrs. Clare. Their hearts went out of them at a bound towards extreme cases, when the subtle mental troubles of the less desperate among mankind failed to win their interest or regard. In jumping at publicans and sinners they would forget that a word might be said for the worries of scribes and Pharisees, and this defect or limitation might have recommended their own daughter-in-law to them at this moment as a fairly choice sort of lost person for their love. Thereupon she began to plod back along the road by which S.E. had come, not altogether full of hope, but full of a conviction that a crisis in her life was approaching. No crisis, apparently, had supervened, and there was nothing left for her to do but to continue upon that Starvaker farm till she could again summon courage to face the vicarage. She did, indeed, take sufficient interest in herself to throw up her veil on this return journey, as if to let the world see that she could at least exhibit a face such as Mercy Chant could not show. But it was done with a sorry shake of the head. It is nothing, it is nothing," she said. "Nobody loves it. Nobody sees it. Who cares about the looks of a castaway like me?" Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.